Hierdie inset word aan jou gebring met die komplimente van Radio Kaapse Kansel 729 AM. Besoek ons gerus by www.capepulpit.co.za.
Dis lekker om jou weer vandag welkom te heet hier by die ABBA-program Krag van die Bybel. Die woord van die Here wat in die gees en krag ook by ons kom. Die woord van die Here, die gees van God en al twee getuig saam. En dit verander ons harte. En dit is wat ons graag wil, deur te luister na die woord en werklik deur die gees vervul. Ook te dink daaroor en te mediteer en te verstaan hoe die Here ons lewe op daai wyse ook verander deur sy krag. Dit gaan in hierdie program oor hoe ek die Bybel lees en hoe dit ek kan mediteer oor dit wat ek lees. Die program het twee dele. Die eerste deel gaan oor die Bible Project spotgooi wat ons nou luister. En vandag se tema is 70 times 7 prophetic math, waar dit vooral ook gaan oor die wonderlike verstaan van Daniël 9, wat 'n baie ongewone Bybel hoofstuk is in die Bybel. Ongewoon en simbolies. En ons gaan luister na John en Tim, wat hulle gesels dan ook in 'n pot gooi oor die getal 7, 70 maal 7, in hierdie geval, en die profetiese verstaan ook daarvan. Ons gaan luister na hulle ongewone manier, maar wonderlike leersame manier, om te verstaan waaroor dit hier gaan. Waarom dit ook so vir Jesus belangrik was, die getal 7. Hierdie program word aangebied deur by Marius Kalekamp en ons noem dit die ABBA-program. Jy kan na die ABBA-webwerf toe ook gaan en gaan kyk wat is daar vir jou in terme van opleiding as 'n beraader en hoe jy kan groei om jou eie lewe te verstaan vanuit die woord van die Here. ABBA se webwerf is abbo.org.za. Gaan kyk gerus op jou browser en vul dit in. abbo.org.za. Jy kan ook Marietjie bel by 084-501-1102. Kaapse Kansel, Radio Kaapse Kansel het ook beraringsdiens waarby jy kan inskakel. Bel gerus Kaapse Kansel by 021-180-5744 en dan sal jy gelei word na 'n berader wat dan sonder enige vergoeding of so is, net te sprake hier nie. Jy kan gerus dan dit wat op jou hart is en dit waarmee jy stoei deel met 'n berader wat aan diens is. Dit is alles vertroulik en jy kan met groot vrymoedigheid daarvan gebruik maak. Andersins kan jy na die ABBA webwerf gaan as jy formele berading wil ontvang by 'n baie goed opgeleide berader. Ons gaan nou eers luister na die Bible Project se potgooi en daarna gaan ons na die potgooi, nadat ons geluister het hoe lekker gemaklik met diepte ook hulle kan gesels rondom in hierdie geval die profetiese wiskunde. Daarna gaan ons dan weer aan met Matteus in die tweede deel van die program van 11 uur af of na 11 gaan ons aan met die program om te luister na die te bespreek ook wat Matteus vir ons deurgee in die Matteus Evangelie waar Jesus met die wonderwerke besig is, maar dan word hy verdag gemaak deur die fariseërs. Bly gerus ingeskakel op die program.
Hey, this is Tim at the Bible Project, and today's episode we're going to be carrying forward a conversation between John and myself about the seventh day rest. We're multiple episodes in. We've been tracing these patterns of the number seven in the storyline of the Bible. We camped out for quite a while on page one, Genesis, and we saw there that the number seven, there's 7 days of creation in the Genesis 1 account, and we go from a place of darkness and disorder, and God creates a world of complete order and beauty in a pattern of seven. And then we just started tracing that through. So many stories of the Bible are riffing off of that basic theme. In fact, the whole story of the Bible, in a way, is working out this gigantic storyline of from darkness and disorder to the seventh day rest. So at this point in the story of the Bible, we've tracked through up to Israel's exile, how God brought them into the promised land, they blew it, and they are exiled in what Leviticus presented as like this inverted pattern of seven. So in this episode, it's our last stop in the Hebrew Scriptures. We're going to focus in on a puzzling and fascinating story in the book of the prophet Daniel. And lo and behold, it all revolves around the number seven. This is in Daniel chapter 9. Daniel is praying for the restoration of Jerusalem and his people from exile. And the answer that he gets is not what he expected. And it all revolves around the meaning and symbolism of the number seven. This story, maybe you're familiar with it, maybe you're not. It has been controversial in interpretation in Jewish communities, in all strands of the Christian tradition. People have really wondered what is going on in this chapter of the Hebrew Prophets. And it turns out that Daniel himself is riffing off of a theme in the book of Jeremiah, the prophet before him, and that chapter that he's riffing off of, it's itself built off of patterns of symbolism in the number seven too. So this is, I think, a really fascinating and exciting chapter in the Old Testament. Jesus was really into this chapter because he mentioned it himself. So let's dive in. Here we go.
Five-minute overview. You want to time me?
Yes.
Okay.
Here, hold on. I'm getting out my timer. Go.
God created the world in 6 days. On the seventh day, he stopped and he settled into creation and he appointed humans to rest with him and to rule with him. This was the human ideal in abundance, and it's lost. Humans are exiled, and instead of abundance, we're ground back down to the dust. But there's still this desire for rest, for this final state of completeness. Shabbat, what God did on the seventh day, it means to stop in order to rest. And it's connected to the seven, the cycle of sevens. And seven has the same kind of, what's the word?
Yeah, it's the same.
It's basically the same word as
letters,
complete.
Same letters. Yeah.
It's the idea of completeness. And so seven becomes super important. And as we continue the narrative, God chooses Abraham and he says, I'm going to give you that kind of rest, that Eden blessing, your family. Well, the problem is Abraham's family is actually enslaved to a violent kingdom, Egypt. And so God has to rescue them from Egypt. And that rescuing from Egypt mirrors the same kind of like pattern of God liberating creation out of chaos and disorder. And so you've got this connection between God creating earth, or creation, so that we can rest in it, is connected to this idea of humans being liberated from death and slavery and violence and the powers. And as he liberates his people, he gives them blueprints for a temple. And part of the blueprints of the temple is also this Sabbath cycle of rest, and how the temple was even dedicated and built. And they're told in the commandments, in the covenant commandments of what it means to be God's people, that one of them is on the seventh day, yeah, stop working.
That's right.
And so the question is like, why is this so important? The seventh day stop. And it's all pointing towards this this hope that creation will be fulfilled again and complete.
Yeah.
And actually, we shouldn't just wait for it. We should practice it now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Practice it on the seventh day where you stop from your work. But then there's all these festivals. There's seven types of holy days or appointed times.
Correct.
And they're all built around sevens and this anticipation for the renewal of creation. Not only that, but on the seventh year, it's the year of release. Like debts are forgiven. It's like we just want creation to just be renewed. It's like, let's make it happen.
Yeah.
And not only that, but then on the seventh cycle of the seventh year, like everything is reset.
Yeah.
It's the year of Jubilee.
Yeah.
And Israel is wandering in the wilderness. It's a new type of slavery. It's a slavery not to some other powers, but it's a slavery to their own disobedience. It's a, and wilderness is also connected to like testing.
Yeah.
And like, are we going to get this right?
Yeah.
Are we going to choose faithfulness and trust? And they go into the land. They celebrate Passover. The land is abundant.
Yeah.
And we see that this theme of trusting is all connected to this idea of stopping and resting. It's how they're supposed to take down Jericho.
Yeah. Yeah, Jericho is taken down in a Sabbath cycle.
In a Sabbath cycle. March for 6 days on the seventh day.
Yeah.
Don't battle.
Yeah.
Stop.
Just, yeah.
And shout.
Yes. Yes.
And God will do it.
Yeah.
And what was that verse in Isaiah that you ended
Isaiah
with?
Isaiah 30, verse 15. In repentance and rest is your salvation. In quietness and trust is your power.
Quietness and trust
is
your power.
That is the theological core of the meaning of the seventh day.
In quietness and trust.
Sabbath
is power.
Is a foretaste of salvation. Therefore, your rest is your power. Your trust, your faith is your power.
How do we get back to this completeness? Do we work for it? Do we fight for it? Or do we stop?
Yeah, and trust that God will give it to us.
Israel doesn't fulfill the covenant. Yeah. They're exiled from the land.
Yeah.
It's a mirror of Adam and Eve being exiled from the garden.
Yeah.
And so now the question remains.
Yep.
How will we get to the state of completeness?
Yeah, now that we've been exiled from the land. That was 5 minutes and 4 seconds.
All right.
That might be as long as the video is going to be.
Yeah.
Hopefully the video will be.
But we still got some ground to cover.
We do. Oh, yeah.
And the video.
Yeah, lots of ground. Yeah, totally. Yeah, that's good.
All right.
Yeah, awesome. Good job. That was good. And it was entertaining. For this part of the conversation, which is going to be how Israel's prophets, the books of the prophets, process this Sabbath, Eden, rest, seventh day, hope for the restoration of Eden and the ultimate seventh day. Let's turn to the last page of the Jewish ordering of the Hebrew Scriptures, which is the last chapter of 2 Chronicles. Most ancient form of the organization of the Hebrew Scriptures is the organization that Jesus called the Torah, the Prophets, and then the Psalms, which names the book that heads the third collection, which is also called the Writings. And the Writings is a diverse collection. It appears that Chronicles was composed as a kind of conclusion to the whole Hebrew Bible. The last chapter is 2 Chronicles 36. And it retells the story of the last king of Israel, the last king of Judah, who Nebuchadnezzar takes out. And it's the story of the sacking of Jerusalem.
This is the story of going in the into exile.
Yeah, totally.
Okay.
Yep. So starting in verse 11 of 2 Chronicles 36, we're introduced to Zedekiah, who's installed as a puppet king by Nebuchadnezzar. Verse 13, he too rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar.
That didn't work out.
So verse 15, Yahweh was sending again and again his messengers, the prophets.
Wait, what verse is this? Where'd you go?
Verse 15.
Okay.
Yahweh was sending again and again his messengers because he loves his people. And he had compassion on his dwelling place. He loves his people and he loves
his land.
Loves that land.
Yeah.
But Israel, continually mocked the messengers of God, despised the prophets. And so the anger of Yahweh rose against his people. There was no turning back. He brought against them the king of the Chaldeans. And Chaldeans is another synonym for the Babylonians.
Mm.
The Babylonians killed their young men with the sword in the temple. They had no compassion on young men, young women, old men, or the sick. All were given into the Babylonians' hands. All the articles of the temple, great and small, the treasures of the temple, and the treasures of the king were all brought to Babylon. They burned the house of God, broke down the walls of Jerusalem, burned its buildings. Just bad news. Verse 20, those who escaped from the sword, basically the people that survived the onslaught, were carried away to Babylon, and they were slaves to him and his sons, until the rule of the kingdom of Persia. Remember, Chronicles is written towards way late.
Yeah.
Like, the restoration of Jerusalem has already happened.
Mm.
The return from exile and the rebuilding of Jerusalem has already happened from this author's point of view.
Yeah, it's crushing through a lot of history real fast.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. But notice what he says here. He says, so think the author's already back in Jerusalem.
So, yeah, Babylonian exile is over.
Second temple's rebuilt. It's not working out, according to Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi.
Yeah.
It's not awesome. And this author ends the story here saying, so remember, he carried those away to Babylon. Verse 21, in order to fulfill the word of Yahweh by the mouth of Jeremiah, the prophet, until the land had enjoyed its Sabbaths. All the days of its desolation, the land kept the Sabbath. Until the 70 years were complete.
Yeah, that's back in Deuteronomy, right?
Yeah, Leviticus 26.
Or Leviticus 26.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, we're building up this rest that's needed.
Mm-hmm.
The land needs to rest.
Yeah. So make sure you let the land, you release it every seventh year and then every jubilee cycle. Remember, so that the land will have its rest along with you.
Mm-hmm.
The author of Chronicles in Hebrew Bible terminology, Hebrew Bible scholarship is called the chronicler, which I like that a lot.
Yeah, the chronicler.
The chronicler. The chronicler.
He's chronicling.
Concludes the story by saying that the exile fulfilled the 70 years of Jeremiah. We'll talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
Jeremiah said exile would last 70 years.
Okay.
But when the chronicler read the book of Jeremiah and took a long walk with a cup of tea, he saw, 70. That's about the Sabbath. And do you remember the upside-down Sabbath of Leviticus 26?
Yeah, this compounding of
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, if you don't obey, exiled. Mm. You continue to not obey, it's going to be seven times in exile.
Correct, yeah. Yep, it's like the anti-release, the anti-jubilee. Yeah, so he sees the exile as the chance for the land to finally get the Sabbaths that the Israelites did not give it. So why does he think that? Like, what led him to that conclusion?
Leviticus 26.
A bunch of things did. Leviticus 26 is for sure on his brain. He's quoting from it,
mm-hmm.
although he doesn't say it all. The only text he says he's quoting from is Jeremiah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So let's pause and go back to Jeremiah, because how Jeremiah thinks about and talks about the exile will help us understand both the meaning of the exile in the prophets, but also the hope for what lies on the other side of exile. So Jeremiah 25... this is the chapter where Jeremiah says, all the nations are corrupt and violent. I'm going to make them all drink a cup of foaming wine. We've talked about this.
Foaming
wine. Recent past. It's the cup of God's anger, God's wrath.
Yeah. Yep.
And the cup is Babylon. To drink the cup means...
Babylon's coming.
Becoming subject to Babylon. So he says to the kings of Israel, Jeremiah 25, verse 11, this whole land will be a desolation and a horror. All these nations around, not just Israel, all their neighbors, will serve the king of Babylon 70 years. Then it will take place when the 70 years are filled full, completed. Then I'll punish the king of Babylon and his nation, declares Yahweh, for their iniquity and the land of the Chaldeans, the Babylonians, I'll make an everlasting devastation. So, in other words, he's going to use Babylon to be an instrument of
judgment,
justice on the nations. But then Babylon itself, like, is going to overstep its bounds.
Yeah.
And then God's going to reduce it to nothing. This is what the book of Habakkuk is about.
Hmm.
Habakkuk, his first complaint is like, look how horrible Israel is.
Mm-hmm.
And so God says, yes, I'm going to raise up the Babylonians. Hmm. And then Habakkuk says, wait, no, they're even worse. You're going to use.
Yeah.
And then that it becomes this cycle that God will even use the nasty empires of the world as instruments of his judgment, not to endorse them,
okay. But
because they're on the scene and he'll work with what he finds.
Hmm.
He works with humans as he finds them.
Yeah.
So the 70-year theme gets repeated in Jeremiah 29, where Jeremiah says, when 70 years are completed for Babylon, those are the 70 years again, I'm going to visit you and fulfill my good word to you and bring you back to this place.
Hmm.
So Babylon will get what's coming to them,
mm-hmm.
and you'll get
back to the land.
For I know the plans I have for you.
Oh.
Plans for good, plans for welfare, not for calamity, to give you a future and a hope. I think that's a famous Bible verse.
That is a famous Bible verse.
For some people, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, you know what? I can think of a family member who has it on their wall.
Mm. Oh, that's hanging on a lot of walls.
Yeah.
It's a classic one.
It's a good calendar verse. Yeah. It's beautiful to mm-hmm. hear that word from God.
Mm-hmm. I know the plans I have for you.
Yeah. It's a good summary of the, not optimistic, but hopeful arc of the biblical story, although optimistic depends on your definition. But
it's a callback.
Yeah. But here it's specifically about you're sitting in Babylon.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. that's the context.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I know the plans I have for you. Verse 12. Then you will call upon me and pray to me, and I'll listen to you.
Hmm.
So this is an explicit thing of, remember this was in Leviticus when you're sitting there in exile.
Oh, right, yeah. And you're going to repent and...
Yeah, circumcised heart,
yeah.
Heart change.
Call out to the Lord.
Yeah, and then God says, then I'll remember my covenant mm-hmm. with my people mm-hmm. and I'll remember the land. So same thing here. When 70 years are complete, I've got good plans for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So just ask me.
Yeah.
Just ask me for them when the 70 years are up. Then you'll seek me and find me when you search for me with all your heart. I will be found.
That's another classic verse.
By you. Yeah, yeah, totally. Jeremiah 29
mm-hmm.
is coming out.
Yeah, bringing the hits.
I will restore your fortunes and gather you from all the nations where I've driven you. I'll bring you back to this place where... Okay, you get the idea. So Jeremiah is pretty... 70 years.
Yeah, he's putting a stake in the ground.
That's
70
right.
years.
So the whole question is, what did Jeremiah have in mind? Not necessarily the author of Jeremiah or of Chronicles, as he thought about. But what did Jeremiah, when he like...
The prophet.
When he's on the street corner. What does 70 mean? People ponder these things. Is 70 just a symbolic round number?
7 is definitely a number full yep. of symbolism.
Totally.
But at the same time, mm-hmm. it's a very concrete number. On the seventh day,
yeah.
stop.
Yeah, that's
Not
right.
like some like symbolic seventh day.
Yeah, that's right.
On the seventh day.
Yeah, on the seventh day.
On the seventh
day.
Year.
Yep, that's
so
right.
So it also could be very literal.
Yeah, yeah. A literal day can have symbolic meaning. What else is the meaning of the Sabbath? All right, it's an actual day. 70 is 7 times 10. And 10 has also been
yeah.
a repeated symbolic number in...
The creation story.
Yep, in Genesis 1, in Exodus,
mm-hmm.
in... The Day of Atonement, which
on the tenth
comes
day.
On this tenth day, the seventh. So there's a lot of 7 and tens
mm-hmm.
in the Sabbath motif,
yeah,
design pattern in the yeah. biblical story.
So let's put them together into
yep.
a power symbol.
Yeah, it is also an average lifetime,
70 years
for the biblical authors. Yeah, Psalm 90. All our days pass away under your anger. 70 years or 80. If
yeah.
our strength endures.
Mm.
Remember, we read Psalm 90 earlier in this conversation. He's reflecting on Genesis 3, returning to the dust.
Mm-hmm.
So he sees that our mortality is a sign of being exiled.
Yeah.
And so what do you get here? He's 70, maybe
about
80.
70 years.
Yeah.
What is the average life expectancy nowadays?
I don't know the answer.
In the U.S., it's 78 years.
Mm-hmm.
78.69.
Wow. That's, yeah, okay. Man.
In the world.
It's coming.
It's coming. It's
yeah.
around the corner. Worldwide, it's 71.
Whoa. Okay.
You know who has the highest? Japan.
Fascinating.
Then Switzerland, Singapore, wow. Australia, Spain, Iceland, Italy, Israel.
Are they up in the 80s or high 70s?
80s, low 80s.
Wow, fascinating. Wow.
You don't break out of the 80s until Costa Rica, wow. 79.6.
Wow.
Man,
wow.
You live longer in Costa Rica than you do in the U.S. love Costa Rica.
You've got some positive associations with Costa Rica.
Yeah.
You have some good memories there.
Mm-hmm.
Being exiled to Costa Rica wouldn't be all bad. Maybe. I don't know. I've never been.
That sounds like a jubilee.
If you were going to think of a number that is the upside down version of the Genesis 1 and 2 Eden ideal, 70 would be a good candidate.
The upside down?
Yeah. Hmm. 10 acts of speech
in
7 days to generate this ideal, Eden ideal of the seventh day.
Yeah.
70 as a period of exile.
Yeah.
As an anti seventh day ideal. That's 70. 70. Would, 70. Yeah. Yeah.
There's a logic.
It's a great candidate for a symbolic number of an inverted Genesis 1. Hmm. But that's all I can leave it at. Hmm. You know, I can't prove it. What's also interesting is it's about on target for how long Israel was actually exiled.
Hmm. Oh, interesting.
Mm-hmm. So if the fall of Jerusalem, remember the city was destroyed in 586. Mm-hmm. And then Babylon was overturned by Cyrus in 539.
This is Persia.
Yep. So that gets you 50-something years. But remember, Jerusalem was actually, the sacking and destruction of Jerusalem was the third visit of Nebuchadnezzar. Mm. He had been there two times in the decade before.
And then he put the puppet king, Zebediah.
Correct. So if you go from the first time Nebuchadnezzar visited Jerusalem, you're up into 67-something years. I mean, you're close to 80. And then...
Close to 70.
Excuse me, close to 70. Gosh.
Okay.
My brain this morning. And then it was a year or two for the Israelites to, you know, put together the operation to go back.
Sure.
That's pretty remarkable. Like, you're right on the ballpark of 70 years.
Yeah.
From people first getting exiled from Jerusalem to the exiles coming back. Hmm. So all of that comes together, you know, where the 70 years became extremely meaningful.
Yeah.
As the people came back in Jerusalem, they're studying their scriptures. Hmm. Prophets and priests are in Jerusalem now really intensely studying their scriptures, forming them into the shape of the text that we are familiar with. Hmm. And you can see why Jeremiah's 70 years would be a big deal.
Yeah.
So we come back to Chronicles, and we can understand why the author of Chronicles would represent the exile of 70 years as Jeremiah's 70 years as a kind of inverted Sabbath.
Yeah, the amount of time that's compounded that needs the land needs to rest.
That's right. Yep.
From Leviticus 26.
Correct. So here's something really interesting that'll kick us into another important work, the Book of Daniel. This is a comment by Hugh Williamson, his commentary on Chronicles. He's commenting on the last paragraph of Chronicles here. He says, this phrase about the land keeping the Sabbath for 70 years has clearly been given a reference backwards by its association with the land enjoying its Sabbaths. Remember in Leviticus 26, the land will get the Sabbath that you didn't give it, okay? And then Chronicles says, 70 years of Jeremiah were all the Sabbaths. The land got its Sabbaths. Mm. Okay? So this suggests that the chronicler has a period of not just 70, but 490 years in mind.
Because there was four.
When does the land
get 70 7-year cycles?
Yes. When does the land get a year of rest?
On the seventh year.
On the Jubilee.
Yeah.
On the Jubilee.
On the Jubilee?
Mm-hmm. Well, it gets it every seven.
Every seven.
And then it gets the supersized rest on the Sabbath.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
Year of Jubilee.
The year of Jubilee.
Yeah.
So do the math here. If the 70 years
If they needed 70
of Jeremiah,
years of rest,
yes.
That means they've missed 7 times 70.
Correct. So for the chronicler, the 70 years of Jeremiah is connected to the number of missed Jubilee years that the land did not get.
Yeah. So there's a 490 years of history.
Yeah. Yes. So here's what Williamson notes.
Okay.
He says, on the basis of the lengths of the reign, which the chronicler himself gives for
all the
kings of Judah, it seems clear he intends this as a reference to cover the whole period of the monarchy, which is more or less coextensive with the years from Saul. The chronicler begins his story after the genealogies. He has 9 chapters of genealogies.
Okay. Starting with?
Thrilling stuff. The first king that he starts with is Saul.
Mm-hmm.
His narrative from Saul all the way up to Zedekiah we just read about, mm-hmm. Williams says, just pay attention to the chronology he gives.
Yeah, it adds
490
up.
Years. Mm. So he framed the history of Israel on the land as 7 times 70, and then making 70 missed Jubilee years.
Mm.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
I think. In terms of theological symbolism, theological chronology.
Sure.
It's a powerful theological statement about the whole history of Israel.
Yeah. It's not a modern way to do history. It's to make years into symbolic.
Oh, we do this all the time.
Do we?
We talk about time in round numbers.
Oh, sure.
For symbolic purposes.
Okay.
Help me think of some examples. Sure.
We talk about decades, like that's a thing.
Okay. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
The 90s.
Yeah, we'll isolate.
The 80s.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, okay.
Like something happened in 1980.
Yeah, totally.
That
yeah.
ended in 1989.
Right. That made the 80s the
80s. Made the 80s.
But there really was a thing that you can call the 80s.
Yeah, there is.
Yeah. Yeah. Technically and symbolically.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is totally normal.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, we're importing our culture's concept of numbers and history and chronology. We're imposing it on the biblical authors when we expect that they would do it the way we would do it. So I think this is brilliant on the chronicler's part. He's framed the whole history of the monarchy in Jerusalem.
That's
as
fascinating.
70
Sabbaths.
Examples of 7 years that didn't get observed, or flip it over, 7 Jubilee.
Oh, right.
Cycles that, oh, no, that's not right.
Because
that would
right.
be every 50th year.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. So 77s.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. Okay. So do we see this anywhere else in the Hebrew Bible? And we do in Daniel chapter 9. And Daniel chapter 9, in fact, takes it a step further.
Okay.
So fascinating.
Daniel is in Babylon.
Yep.
It's still exile.
Yep.
So this 70 years of exile is still happening right now.
Yeah.
We're somewhere in the thick of that.
That's right. Though look at the first sentence of Daniel 9. In the first year of Darius, son of Ahasuerus, from the Medes, who was made king over the kingdom of the Chaldeans. So, in other words, Darius was not a Babylonian. He's a Mede, and he just took over the Babylonian kingdom. Remember what Jeremiah said? I'm 70 years, you'll serve Babylon, and I'm taking Babylon down.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a little hyperlink to say, dear reader.
It's happening.
It's the 70th year.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
Wasn't it a Persian that was supposed to take?
Yes. Medes and the Persians were a cooperative kingdom.
Okay.
At first. So Darius was the first, and then Cyrus comes right after.
Okay.
Yep. So, the first sentence of Daniel 9 tells
you're in
the
70th year.
It's the 70th year.
Mm.
Yeah.
Cool.
Which makes sense of what follows next.
Okay.
I, Daniel, was observing in the books, in the scriptures, the number of the years revealed as the word of the Lord to Jeremiah, the prophet, to complete the desolations of Jerusalem, namely
70 years.
7 years.
Here we are.
So, I mean, it's
Christmas morning.
Totally. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. What's the analogy? Yes, it's Christmas morning.
Yeah.
You've been waiting for it?
You've been waiting for it.
You knew it was coming.
Yeah, you knew it was coming. You've been counting down.
Yep. So, all of a sudden, in the 70th year, Daniel's having a little Bible study of Jeremiah.
Yeah.
So, do you remember what Jeremiah said? He said,
just like Y2K. Yeah. Everyone's waiting. What's going to happen?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Remember, Jeremiah said, when the 70 years are up, if my people call out to me.
Yeah.
Remember? If they call to me and seek me with all their hearts. Mm-hmm. So I, Daniel, gave my attention to Yahweh God to seek him by prayer and supplication.
Nice.
What follows in verses 4 through 20 is one of the most beautiful prayers of confession in the Hebrew Bible. Mm. And remember Daniel. Remember Daniel's character in the book of Daniel. Mm-hmm. He passes every test.
Yeah, he
like stands out in the story. Mm-hmm. But you read Daniel 9 and you would think he is like the worst sinner in Israel's history.
Yeah.
It's really fascinating. He personally owns the sins of his ancestors.
Hmm. Wow. It's a lot of humility.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a beautiful prayer. I didn't include it here because it would derail us. Hmm. But it's an amazing prayer. So while I was still praying, a man, Gavriel, came to me, a spiritual being who looks like a human. And he gave me some instruction. He spoke to me and said, Daniel, I've come to give you some insight here.
A message.
Yeah. So, and what he says is, 77s have been determined concerning your people and concerning your holy city. Let's pause there. The first 70 just passed.
Yeah.
And he thought, by Jeremiah's count, that's the end.
Yeah.
But what if those 70 years of Jeremiah were just the first of 70
of seven
of, right? That's 70s. The idea. Yeah. 770s.
Oh, man.
And when you sit with Leviticus 26 that said, I'll visit seven times punishment of exile, or seven times, compounding. And so Gabriel shows up and says, sorry, dude, we're just getting started.
That's a rough message. Here.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's not that the 70 years is being like reinterpreted here. It's rather that the 70 years is just beginning a much longer cycle of 70.
But didn't you just say
70 times 7?
But Israel got to go back after 70 years.
Ah, that's interesting. Yeah, what's that about? So some Israelites returned and rebuilt the temple in Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
So
the second temple.
The second temple. Yeah. Yeah. Zerubbabel, Ezra, Nehemiah.
Mm-hmm.
So in theory, that was
should be
the end of the exile. That's when the prophets, the hopes of the restored Eden would happen, yeah?
Yeah.
And it didn't happen.
Hmm.
And then Daniel, it's as if Daniel's being given insight here. Dear reader, the return from exile was not the real ultimate return from exile.
Hmm.
This is what our exile video was about.
It was just one of seven.
Yeah. Yeah, the ultimate restoration. It's as if the return from exile to actual Jerusalem becomes just itself another symbol in the pattern, pointing to the ultimate restoration from exile.
Just keeps getting pushed back.
Keeps getting pushed back, and it keeps getting bigger.
Yeah.
Because all of a sudden, like, Jerusalem's not the thing? I thought Jerusalem was the thing.
The temple in Jerusalem.
Yeah. And then, as we're going to see, it's the temple and the land in Isaiah and Ezekiel get a cosmic upgrade to what their ultimate symbolism was always about, which is the whole of creation.
Mm.
That the temple is a microcosm of the whole world, and the land is a symbol of the temple, which is the symbol of all creation.
Mm.
So the return under Ezra Nehemiah is here being portrayed as not the ultimate.
It's being downplayed.
Yeah. But it's as significant as was the exodus from Egypt. That wasn't the ultimate liberation, but it was a foretaste of it.
Mm, okay.
Mm-hmm. So Daniel's told 490 more,
Oy.
Which is symbolically, it maps.
420 more.
477s. Hold on. So 490 was the years the kings were screwing things up in the land.
That was 10 times 70.
Now it's 490 on the other side. So you have 490, but they were on the land, not giving the land its Sabbath.
Sorry, yeah, not 10 times 70.
They just went through a 70.
Okay.
And then here he is now at that point, and then he's learning 77s.
Even more on top of that.
Are appointed. Yep, that's right.
Oh, so this isn't like you did the first cycle of what's going to be even six more.
Correct. Yeah.
It's like so there's a whole new
Yep, there's
thing
another
happening.
70 times seven ahead.
Oh, my goodness.
Here's what's going to happen in those 77s. Finishing the rebellion. Actually, that's bad. That doesn't help. In English, that doesn't help you get the idea. Because finish means to put an end to. For the rebellion
to come
to its completion.
Yeah, to complete.
So Israel's rebellion is not over. Like, you're praying to me, Daniel. But the rest of your people are like... I mean, you got Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They're cool. But the point is, you know, Israel as a whole is still in a state of rebellion.
Okay.
Here's the second thing that needs to happen that's not finished yet. Sealing up sins. Israel's sins have not been brought to an end. They're still continuing. Atonement for evil. Israel's evil has still yet to be fully dealt with. Here's another thing that needs to take place within these 77s. Bringing eternal righteousness to seal up vision and prophecy. So if you thought, Daniel, that the 70th year was going to be heaven and earth becoming one, I'm sorry. I mean, you get the idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Look around.
Yeah.
There's still some work to do.
Yep. He gets sick and he can't sleep after this. I mean, just imagine.
Yeah, I mean, he's been waiting. Wow. He's been counting down.
Yes, just like you would count, just like you would wait for the year of Jubilee.
Yeah.
He's been waiting for this
year. Can you imagine coming to like your kid on Christmas morning and he's ready to go and you're like, sorry, buddy.
Yeah, yeah.
We're going to wait till you're 14.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right.
And then we'll do Christmas.
That's right. So, Daniel, let me tell you this. For these 77s, when these 77s will start, let me tell you when they're going to start. The new 7 times 70. From the issuing of the declaration to return and rebuild Jerusalem until the anointed one, which is the Hebrew word Mashiach, there will be 7 sevens and 62 sevens.
That's 69 sevens.
So... and then I have dot, dot, dot. The passage goes on and becomes extremely complex in Hebrew and in a diversity of interpretations. Mm. But from the declaration to return and rebuild Jerusalem. So when does that happen?
The king of Persia lets him go do that, right?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Yeah. In fact, that's the last sentences of Second Chronicles.
And they shall go up.
Exactly. It's the king saying, return to Jerusalem and rebuild Jerusalem, whoever God is with him, and let him go up. And it ends with an incomplete sentence.
Yeah.
So it seems like the chronicler wants to coordinate the ending of his book with counting down of this clock
here. Interesting.
In other words, the Book of Chronicles ends by setting a timer.
With the moment that God said,
Gabriel
is talking, right?
Gabriel, yeah, that's right.
But Yahweh's messenger says that the next set of 77s begins with this declaration.
To return and rebuild
Jerusalem. The Hebrew scriptures ends with that declaration.
Correct.
Wow. Yep.
Intelligent life
in
the shaping of these books.
Yeah.
I mean, it actually is a perfect metaphor to say the Hebrew Bible concludes by setting a timer that starts ticking the moment you close the book.
What are we supposed to be thinking about this type of timer at this point?
You know? Oh, in terms of what you mean?
Well, I mean...
Because these are symbolic numbers.
Is it a symbolic number?
Okay.
Daniel waited to the 70th year.
Yeah, right. That's right.
And to him, it was not just... I mean, it was a year was soaked with symbolism, but it was a real year.
Correct. It was a real year. Yeah. So welcome to a fascinating little industry in biblical scholarship. Because here's what we know is that almost every Jewish group that left a literary record in history, whether it's the Qumran crew, Greek-speaking Druze, Pharisees, the Zealots who launched multiple waves of rebellion against Rome, and the early Christians, everybody's talking about Daniel 9. And you can see why.
Yeah.
It sets the clock.
Yeah.
It sets the clock. So what you have in Second Temple literature is all this interest in the meaning of the 490 years.
Yeah.
And what you find is a diversity of interpretations.
Okay.
Yeah. So you can just say, first there's diversity in when exactly did the clock start.
Okay.
Some start it with King Cyrus. giving his declaration, which would be in 539 BC.
Okay.
So 490. I always forget this on my calculator.
539 minus 490.
Yeah. Oh, I think it gives you to 63.
BC?
BC. Here, I'm doing that from memory. Here, I got it.
What was the number again?
539 minus...
539 minus 490.
49 BC. What happened in 49 BC? Nothing that seems to fit the circumstances. There are some people who thought what was going on with the Maccabean revolt against Antiochus in the 160s BC. Mm. There were people that pulled Daniel 9's fulfillment in towards that.
Okay.
Now, in that case, it's a symbolic reading of the numbers.
Sure, because it's not exactly there, but
totally.
It's close.
It's within a century.
A century.
Early Christians were really keen on aligning Jesus' birth with this.
Yeah.
Or his execution.
You just got to get about 40 years.
You got to push. Yeah, totally. Yeah. So if anyone's interested, there's a scholar, Roger Beckwith, has done like the study here. Daniel 9 and the date of the Messiah's coming in Essene, Hellenistic, Pharisaic, Zealot, and early Christian computation.
Wow.
It's exhaustive. But it's helpful to just see the early Christians weren't the only ones interested.
Yeah.
Everybody was interested.
Yeah.
In Daniel 9.
Yeah.
Because everybody understood it was setting some kind of clock for the ultimate restoration.
Yeah.
From exile, which, depending on your view of what happened with Jesus, did or did not happen. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. What were those things again? The rebellion coming to completion.
Yep.
Sins being sealed up. Atonement for evil.
Bringing eternal righteousness. And finishing. Bringing to fulfillment vision and prophecy.
Hmm.
Yeah. The full package deal is anticipated at the end of this 490. And what is the 490? It's the inverted jubilee. It's the anti-jubilee that is exile.
But it's also, according to the chronicler, a very exact number of how many Sabbath cycles release years were missed.
Well, it's an exact number that has immense symbolic significance.
Yeah.
77s.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, usually it's people's approaches that they already have coming to the Bible that will determine the outcome here. For somebody who's really sees that numbers can be symbolic, even literal numbers can be symbolic, will create more comfort with ambiguity in the actual, what we would call actual chronology.
Mm.
And to say you can have symbolic periods of time. So I'm cool with Jesus' birth in 4 BC being 45 years off of that like actual chronology. So that's where some people land. Other people will not be comfortable with that. And so they'll find, well, maybe there was a later declaration to rebuild Jerusalem.
Mm.
Maybe there was something else that actually starts the clock.
Mm.
And so different people line up.
In the church I grew up in, there was a season of obsession with Daniel and Revelation.
Yeah, yeah.
And I never was involved in any of those.
Yeah.
They got really geeky. And I think they must have had some
interpretation. Oh, yes. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, in the heyday of the popularity of American dispensationalism, which is still a very influential popular Christian movement, but it does seem to have had a peak of influence in the 80s. These dates become really important. And then they get coordinated with patterns of seven in the book of Revelation. And then people were looking at different wars in Iraq and George Bush and all this kind of, it all got brought together here.
Yeah.
And then people start predicting the dates of, the return of Christ or the war of Armageddon and so on. And, and then you have other Christians who just think all of that is fundamentally misguided. And everybody is appealing to the Bible.
Yeah,
that begins to make you think, oh, this is really a debate about our preloaded assumptions that we bring to the Bible. Because the Bible can apparently be made to say many things depending on the assumptions that you come to it with. So that's a really important conversation. I meant to lead us like right to the brink of it, but not to actually have it.
Yeah, I don't think we can. We can't do justice right now.
That's right. Joyce Baldwin has written a commentary on Daniel in the Tyndale Old Testament Commentary series that's so helpful. It's very accessible. You don't have to know Greek or Hebrew or anything. She does probably the best place that I've seen in laying out the different views, how different groups in our day approach these dates in Daniel 9, reasons for holding different views and problems with each view. And she has her own view, but she, you know, puts it on a list of a number of others. It's just a helpful survey. It just helps you respect why people hold the different views that they do.
Yeah. How do modern day Jewish communities think about this?
Oh, there's as much diversity as there is in the Christian tradition.
Yeah. That so, something happened.
It depends on your group. There are some that, see the Messianic era as a symbolic hope. There are others that have done a more secular job on all of this, maybe on analogy to some of the modern mainline denominations in America, that turn it into a symbol of when humans get their act together and God graces us with the ability to love each other. So let's do that now. To others, other Jewish groups that are very much still waiting for a coming Messiah.
490 has become a very long period of time.
Yeah, thousands of years now. Yeah. That's right. Yep, the different ways of accounting for that. Personally, I'm comfortable with it being a round symbolic number. One, because of the way that sevens and tens have already accumulated a symbolic significance in the story. Another one is the next passage to talk about, which is Isaiah 61, which is doing similar symbolic theology of the Jubilee year, but doesn't attach it to a number as such, but attaches it to a future hope, independent of number calendar schemes.
Okay.
And so even within the Hebrew Bible, sometimes numbers can be a way of anticipating this hope. Other times, it's the hope itself and not the numbers. And me, that's at least made me chill out about trying to figure out how the numbers actually work out. The Beckwith article is a great place to start if you want to nerd out on the numbers. Last stop in the prophets.
Yeah, this was supposed to be the whirlwind tour. We got a little bit.
Yeah, it's okay. It's all right.
We got a little bit
with Daniel
stuck
9.
Stuck there in Daniel 9.
Yeah, everybody gets trapped in Daniel 9.
Daniel 9 vortex.
It's a vortex.
Isaiah 61. The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me. Should I say Lord or Yahweh? Sometimes you say it.
Yeah, your choice. Yeah.
Okay. The Spirit of Yahweh God is upon me because Yahweh has anointed me, Isaiah, to bring good news to the afflicted. Is that, no, or is it Isaiah?
We'll talk about the me.
The me.
Yeah, okay. The me is unidentified explicitly.
Okay.
Yeah.
The Lord has anointed me, someone, to bring good news, gospel, to the afflicted. And he has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim release to captives and freedom to prisoners, to proclaim the year of the favor of Yahweh and the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all who mourn, to grant those who mourn in Zion, giving them a garland instead of ashes, the oil of gladness instead of mourning, the mantle of praise instead of a spirit of fainting. So they will be called oaks of righteousness, the planting of the Lord. Oh, the planting of the Lord, that he may be glorified.
Okay. So we've got a me.
We've got a me.
A me.
The Spirit of Yahweh God has appointed me.
One who's empowered by the Spirit and anointed. Mashach.
Which is, which means a Messiah, anointed one.
Yep. And two figures are anointed in the Hebrew Bible, priests and kings. And the person who anoints priests and kings are prophets, who does the anointing. So this is big thing. Section of Isaiah 49. Into the 60s, there's been a persona developing in the drama of the poetry, and it's a me. a me. And it's the me is introduced in Isaiah 48 and 49. And the me is somebody whom God calls Israel.
He calls the me Israel.
He calls the me, yeah, or at least the me tells us that God called me Israel and then gave me a mission to go restore Israel to himself.
Hmm. Yeah.
So it's an individual
who is being himself given somehow Israel.
Yeah, being given the mantle of the whole nation to go on a mission to his nation and restore them back to covenant loyalty. So it's a some kind of representative. The only other spirit-empowered person in Isaiah we met back in chapter 11, it's the little sprout that comes up from the stump of Jesse.
Mm. The sevenfold.
The new David, yes. And he's given the sevenfold spirit. So the book of Isaiah is forming a mosaic portrait of the coming deliverer.
Yeah.
He's a king from the line of David. He's a new prophet. He's a new Moses.
New David.
Isaiah 53, he plays a priestly role, but giving himself to die for the sins of his people. So Isaiah 61, this me speaks up. He's an anointed one. And he's announcing Doror, which is...
The release.
The release. That's the word from Leviticus 25, the Jubilee year.
Yeah.
He's announcing the Jubilee year.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. The seventh seven. Mm. Which me... And look at the images. Good news for the suffering.
Yeah.
The brokenhearted people grieved are having their hearts like bandaged.
Hmm.
Good metaphor. Prisoners, captives. This is liberation.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is the Sabbath, seventh day image.
Mm.
That's what the Jubilee is about.
Yeah.
Remember, debts are canceled.
Mm-hmm.
Slaves are freed.
Mm-hmm.
Land is restored to its Eden-like condition.
Mm.
Notice also in verse 3, you notice something about the trees.
The people are going to be these pretty mighty trees.
Yes.
People planted.
People are trees.
People are trees. That's a metaphor in the Bible.
Yeah.
People as trees.
Yep.
And
that sounds like Psalm 1.
Mm, yeah. Yeah.
The person who meditates on Torah.
Where did we see this before, though, too, in the Torah somewhere? That
Yes.
They were planted.
Yeah. Yeah.
In the Promised Land?
Yeah.
Was it the word used?
The first worship song.
Okay.
After the rescue from
Exodus 15.
In Exodus 15. Yeah, the rescue through the waters. God says he's going to plant the people in the mountain of his inheritance.
Yeah.
Where he will reign forever and ever as king.
Yeah.
Yeah. Same thing.
Yeah.
Same thing. So the people will become righteous oak trees that are planted in the new Eden.
Here Isaiah is prophesying about this Jubilee release into back into the Eden ideal.
Correct.
Yeah. And the Jubilee happens every 50 years, but this one seems really special.
Mm-hmm.
That not only is it doing what the Jubilee is supposed to do, anticipating new creation, it seems to actually be bringing new creation.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a question for you. So the Jubilee is 7 times 7 years, and Daniel, it's 70 times 7 years.
Correct. Yeah.
And that's another kind of Jubilee, right?
Yes.
Because after 7 times 70 years is like a type of liberation out of exile.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
So we've got two separate sets of numbers, both representing...
Oh, that's right. Both representing the same
reality. Same idea.
The hope for return from exile. Yeah. This is what I meant when I said Isaiah 61 is using the 50th year Jubilee concept.
Yeah.
Jeremiah, Daniel, 9, Chronicles is working with the 770s.
Yeah.
Or 77s, 70.
They're really 70. Overlapping symbols.
Correct. Again, this is why I have become more comfortable with the numbers being symbols that point to the same, different numbers can point to the same reality.
Yeah.
Because here it's the 50th year of release.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And so we have a messianic figure, literally, in Hebrew, the word is Mashach.
Mm-hmm.
We have a Messiah announcing gospel to the suffering who are still awaiting the ultimate restoration from exile.
Yeah. And what does that mean to be? Like, on one level, we want to go back. There was this awesome temple, and we were our own people.
Yeah.
So that on one level.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But you read the Hebrew scriptures, and at what point was that actually Eden, right? Like, with the temple and
the
land.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah, that's
there was,
right.
Like, maybe little tastes of it, but in general... It wasn't working.
No, it was ambiguous.
Yeah.
Just like Solomon, you know, he's presented as a new Adam who asks for God's wisdom, but
Yeah.
He ends up making some bad choices along
and
the
so
way.
And so what are we really hoping for?
Yeah.
It's, yeah. Well, everyone who mourns is comforted, and it's looking to something even bigger.
Correct. In other words, these texts after the exile are looking back and rereading their whole history in the land as a shadow and a pointer forward to an ultimate reality. In fact, here, this is good. This is an essay by Bradley Gregory. It's an essay on this passage in Isaiah. Mm. It's called The Post-Exilic Exile in Isaiah. In other words, after the first return from the exile, the Hebrew Bible's being shaped to tell you we're still waiting for an ultimate return from exile.
Yeah.
Even though they're geographically back in the land. Mm. So this is a helpful distinction. Some have returned to the land and found that the restoration hasn't happened. The Hebrew Bible makes a distinction between the return to the land in Ezra and Nehemiah and the ultimate restoration promised by the prophets. Mm. So here's how Bradley puts it. He says, in Isaiah 40 to 55, the Babylonian exile is understood as an image of the Egyptian captivity.
Being slaves in Egypt and being exiles in Babylon.
There's all these hyperlinks in these chapters of Isaiah to the slavery in Egypt and liberation from Egypt. Mm-hmm. As the image for now we're in Babylon, yeah, waiting a new exodus. Mm-hmm. In the last 10 chapters of Isaiah, the oppressive situation in Jerusalem after the exile has become another symbol. In other words, Isaiah 56 to 66 imagines that we're back in the land, mm-hmm, and things are horrible here. Mm. So we're back in Jerusalem awaiting another restoration. Okay. Mm. One gets the impression that the author doesn't see the situation after the exile as any better than the situation in Babylon, mm, or enslaved in ancient Egypt.
Right.
In all cases, Israel is shackled because of sin, awaiting deliverance by Yahweh. The prescriptions for the Jubilee year have been
eschatologized.
Academic speech here. Eschatologized. In other words, the Jubilee year
is pushed into a future hope.
Is being read by biblical authors after the exile as a map for future hope.
Yeah.
Not just like, oh, here's something our ancestors did that was interesting.
Or here's something we need to do every 50 years.
Yeah.
It's like, here's something that's pointing towards,
yeah,
this ultimate,
yeah,
rest.
That's right. So by seeing a typological portrayal of the enslaved Israelites in Leviticus 25, in the Jubilee year, slaves are released.
Yeah.
So the biblical authors are going back to their ancient texts, mm-hmm, and being like, whoa, the slaves that get released, mm, in the Jubilee year, that's a way to imagine our whole history, mm-hmm, and a way to imagine exile. It's a way to imagine us right now sitting in Jerusalem, mm-hmm, and we're still just as bad as we were before the exile. Mm. We're still enslaved, mm, awaiting the Jubilee. That's what he's saying. Mm. Biblical authors reading earlier biblical texts.
Yeah.
There you go.
We're still slaves.
Yeah. So Isaiah has moved the concept of Jubilee from a law to an image of future deliverance. Mm-hmm. And this is the same move we find in all other Second Temple Jewish texts that talk about the Jubilee. Mm. So the Jubilee becomes an image of future hope because that's how the biblical authors themselves are presenting it. The Hebrew Bible, man, what an amazing document. You can see why precisely around the time of Jesus, there was this fever pitch, mm, of anticipation of the coming kingdom of God. You got Rome, mm-hmm, this is the new Babylon, and you're just waiting for some kind of renewal restoration movement. And Jesus comes onto the scene, activating all of this.
Yeah.
I mean, intentionally activating all of this stuff.
Yeah, it's not like you can maybe like try to read it into what he's doing. It's literally what he's doing.
He's literally activating the metaphorical symbols.
Yes. He's saying this is happening.
Yeah.
The year of Jubilee is happening.
It's here. The humble will inherit the land. Mm. Think of the Beatitudes.
Those who mourn will.
Yes.
Yeah.
The real winners who will inherit the land are the people getting stomped on right now.
Oh.
And who follow me. And the people who will really get planted in the real renewed creation, the new Eden, are those who follow me and don't go the way of the zealots, hmm, or the Pharisees. Yeah. So Jesus was announcing the arrival of this ultimate seventh day, which is why he quoted from all these texts,
yeah,
that we just spent so much time surveying. Hmm. And for me, there's just so much payoff to come back to the Gospels then and to see Yeah. He thought about, Jesus grew up on all these texts that we just,
yeah.
And he thought and prayed and sang all these texts.
Mm.
They filled his mind and heart. And, you know, for him to stand up in Nazareth, as we'll read, and say, like, today, it starts today.
Mm.
Just imagine that.
Mm-hmm. I'm excited.
Thank you guys for listening to this episode of the Bible Project podcast. Real time, this episode is coming out in December 2019. And for this whole month at the Bible Project, we have been saying thank you to all of you who are getting behind what we're doing and supporting what we're doing. And specifically, we wanted to share right now a cool story about what one family has been doing with the podcast. You should hear the story from the Petersons.
I'm Josh Peterson.
Hi, I'm Nels Peterson, Josh's dad, and he's got three brothers. Ben is the oldest, then Josh and Zach and Thomas. With the boys all living in different areas of the West Coast, not seeing each other often, I wanted a way to stay connected, have commonality, and I thought, what better way to have good discussion than with the podcast? So I proposed the idea of listening to an episode a week and having text discussion. So we started listening to the Bible Project as a group about a year and a half ago, and it's been fun to have it become more than what I was hoping it would be. I was hoping just to maintain relationship and commonality, that when we do get together, it's not, good to see you, you know.
That's the last 6 months, Ben.
Right, right. But there's actually more depth.
Yeah. And I think that's been totally true. I've seen that, especially just when we do get together. We have a lot more to talk about. Yeah, we haven't necessarily had anything like that, I don't think.
Short of dirt biking. But...
Well, right, right. I think, well, at least in our adult lives as right. a family, we haven't had anything where it's like, yeah, this is something that we as like the boys, the Peterson boys, get to do. It's like just our thing.
Yeah. So a couple of my sons that weren't able to be here with Josh and I wrote a couple of thoughts that they wanted to share. This is what Ben says. Listening and discussing the Bible Project with my brothers and dad has helped solidify some of my beliefs and stretched others. It has also helped me grow closer to my family as we discuss the truths that we have discovered. And Thomas doesn't always engage, but I know he's listening. When yeah. he does throw something out, it's like, oh, you were paying attention.
Paying attention.
Yes. All right. Thomas's thoughts. My thoughts in the Bible Project podcast. It's been a great tool for a guided, open discussion between us as a family on the more grand story of the Bible. I've found them incredibly approachable, and the vernacular they use very applicable to us by creating a bridge between old Hebrew meanings and today's world. Doing them together has also given me a chance to know my brothers better because of the perspectives they bring. There's a deepened sense of togetherness and new appreciations for how the story of the Bible affects us all differently in our own journeys. Totally free to include or not include any of this. Just my immediate thoughts. Okay, Thomas, that's a little deep for immediate thoughts. I'd encourage people with doing something like this, people that you don't come in contact often, but they're close. Today's world, today's digital world, brings everybody so much closer than ever before, and taking advantage of the tools like texting to do a podcast together or talk about it just makes sense to me. It's just a texting discussion, but it's still diving into the scripture and learning from each other.
It's really amazing to hear stories like that. I have my head in a pile of books through a lot of the week, and then John come up and have these conversations, and it's so amazing to hear how these conversations can be helpful for other people and people like the Petersons to help their families connect in kind of new and creative ways. So thank you all for supporting the Bible Project and being excited about what we're doing so that we can share. If you want to find out more about what we're up to at the Bible Project or some kind of like big picture dreams that we have for the project as a whole, check out our website at thebibleproject.com or thebibleproject.com/vision. This episode of the Bible Project podcast was produced by Dan Gummel. The theme music is from the band Tense. We, as always, are collecting your listener questions about this series we've been in on the seventh day rest. So if you have questions about the series, feel free to email them to info@jointhebibleproject.com. You can do audio or video recording, keep it around 20 or 30 seconds, and we look forward to hearing from you. Thanks, you guys, and we'll see you next week.
Nou kom terug by die ABBA-program Krag van die Woord. Die Bybel wat ons lees en waarin ons God se geopenbaarde wil kan lees, sy wysheid wat hy op een besondere wyse vir ons gegee het deur sy instrumente deur wie hy gewerk het, mense. Ons lees dan die eerste deel van die gedeelte waaroor ons vandag gaan gesels, Matteus 9 van vers 27. Toe Jesus van daar af verder gaan, het twee blindes agter hom begin aanloop en uitgeroep: "Ontferm u oor ons, seun van David." Daar het Jesus die huis binnen gegaan het, het die blindes na hom gekom en Jesus het vir hulle gesê: "Glo julle dat ek dit kan doen?" Hulle antwoord hom: "Ja, Here." Toe het Jesus hulle oë aangeraak en gesê: "Laat met julle gebeur soos julle glo." En hulle oë is geopen. Jesus het hulle ernstig aangespreek en gesê: "Sorg dat niemand hiervan weet nie." Maar hulle het uitgegaan en die nuus oor hom in daardie hele omgewing versprei. Hulle toe vertrek en kyk, 'n man wat stom was en deur 'n demoon besete is na hom gebring. Daar het die demoon uitgedryf is en die stomme begin praat. Die skare was verwonderd en het gesê: "So iets is nog nooit in Israel gesien nie." So iets is nog nooit in Israel gesien nie. Maar die fariseers het gesê: "Deur die aanvoeder van die demone drijf hy die demone uit." Jesus het in al die stede en dorpies rondgegaan, in hulle sinagoges geleer, die evangelie van die koninkryk verkondig en elke siekte en elke kwaal genees. Toe hy die skare sien, het hy hulle innig jammer gekry, omdat hulle verward en verstrooi was. Soos skape sonder 'n herder. Toe sê hy vir sy disippels: "Die oes is groot, maar die arbeiders min. Bid daarom dat die Here van die oes, dat hy die arbeiders uitstuur om sy oes in te samel." Hierdie, aan die einde van hoofstuk 9, is dit, na die bergrede, het Jesus wat vertel Matteus dan oor die baie wonderwerke wat Jesus doen. In hierdie gedeelte dan, die laaste van hierdie reeks oor die wonderwerke, genesing van die twee blindes en die stomme, die fariseers se verdagmaking van Jesus, en dan Jesus wat sê daar is min arbeiders. In hierdie hoofstukke 8 en 9, is baie duidelik wie Jesus is. En dit is wat Matteus deurbring aan die vroeg-christelike gemeentes, wat hierdie evangelies, wat Matteus, Lukas, en Markus, en Johannes deurgeskryf het, en waar het gelees is, is het baie duidelik, dat Jesus nie sommer net 'n healer was nie. Hulle het dit al reeds geweet in hierdie gemeentes, maar Matteus wil dit vir hulle deurgee. Hierdie Jesus is nie maar net 'n besondere mens nie. Ja, hy is dit ook, maar baie meer. Hy is nie maar net nog 'n profeet nie. Hy is die Messias. Hy kom van God. Hy is die Seun van God. En omdat die vroeg-christelike gemeentes meestal uit Jode bestaan het, maar dat die gedeelte onder die heidene groter geword het, wat tot bekering gekom het en in die gemeentes was, maar hier is het baie belangrik dat Matteus dit beklemtoon. Hy, Jesus, die Messias, die Seun van God, hy kom van God. En dan hier waar hy die blindes en die stomme genees, en die verlamde genees, en die vrou met bloedvloeiing, malaatse, siekes gesond maak, die see en die wind stil maak, demone uitdryf, en Jairus sy dogtertjie uit die dood opwek. Ja, Jairus, wat Lukas gee dit vir ons, dit was Jairus sy dogtertjie. Dit het die mense rondom Jesus gesien, dis op 'n vlak wat nog nooit gehoor gesien is nie. Meer nog, hy doen dit omdat hy die skare mense, die stikkende mense, die mense wat swaar het, jammer kry, omgee vir hulle, uit sy liefde vir die mens. Die mens, die kroon van die skepping wat hy gemaak het, die beeld van God. Ja, en dit moet ons onthou, want mens vergeet het so makkelijk, wat het word beklemtoon in ander gedeeltes in die woord. Jesus, die Seun van God, hy wat hierdie dinge doen, hy was daar in die begin, voor die skepping, hy was daar met die skepping, want God het deur hom alles geskep, hy het voor alles bestaan, hy is die oorsprong, sê Kolossense 1, en Johannes, sê Evangelie, sê dit duidelik in vers 1, Jesus is die woord, hy was in die begin by God, deur hom het alles, deur hom het, alles het deur hom ontstaan. In hom was die lewe, en die lewe was die lig vir die mense. En toch is die mense rondom Jesus so vasgevang in hulle eie stikkendheid, in hulle eie sintuiglike wêreld van mag en aanvaarding en so baie dinge wat hulle vrees. En hier by die fariseers ook die mag en die aansien wat hulle kan verloor. En dan wanneer die drukking so groot is op jou, dan kom dit uit wat in jou hart is. En so is hierdie mense, al sien hulle hierdie dinge, het hulle so baie ander dinge beleef en gesien hulle lewe, hulle kan dit nie glo nie. Gloos is Matteus het juist beklemtoon hier in hoofstuk 9 ook mense wat glo dat Jesus hulle heel kan maak en dan kom hulle na hom, wat glo dat hy hulle kan laat sien, wat glo dat hulle genees kan word, hulle kom in geloof wat hulle weet hy kan dit doen, hy is die Here. En so ook selfs die mense wat ander bring om gezond te word, want hulle glo hy kan dit doen. Maar dit is so makkelijk om mense se klein geloof, die omstanders, selfs die fariseers, om hulle te oordeel. Maar dan, wanneer ons eerlik word oor ons eie lewe, en wanneer ons verstaan wat in ons eie lewe gebeur, hoe makkelijk ons kan sê, nee, ek, dit kan nie, hoe kan dit met my gebeur? Omdat ons geloof dan faal, omdat dit te swaar raak om ons, dan is dit moeilik om in geloof te weet, maar hy is die Here. Hy is die een wat genees, ook vir my. Daar is makkeliker om die mediese wetenskap te glo. Dit is makkeliker om ek lees of sien op TV of op YouTube of waar ook al. En dan glo ons daar die dinge. Ja, baie dinge is feite, is waargeneem deur die wetenskap. Maar is net waargeneem. Maar hy wat hier Jesus die Here is, hy is die een wat alles gemaak het. Hy is nie net waargeneem nie. Hy is die een deur wie alles ontstaan het. En hy vra vir hierdie mense wat hom kom, glo julle dat ek het kan doen. En daarom die vraag vir jou ook, liewe luisteraar. Glo jy die Here kan jou gesond maak? Glo jy die Here kan jou genees? Glo jy die Here het jou lief? Glo jy die Here gee om vir jou? Of sê jy daai tyd is verby? Of ek het feite, dit werk nie so in my lewe nie. Ja, dit is maklik om so te begin dink. Dit is maklik om klein van geloof te word. Want nou, hier kom die Here. En hy vra vir jou, glo jy? Glo jy dat ek die een is, wat alles kom nuut maak? Deur my gaan alles heel gemaak word. Alle siekte genees. Die hele skepping in my nuut gemaak word. Glo jy hom? Dink daaroor. Wanneer ons ook nou luister na musiek, bly toch ingeskakel en ons gesels verder dan oor wat hier gebeur. Wat Matteus ons bring om te sê, maar glo jy? Bly ingeskakel. Ons gesels dan nou verder oor Matteus 9, Jesus se wonderwerke en dan die Fariseërs se verdagmakery en die mense wat verward is, maar bo alles Jesus wat omgee, hulle jammer kry, hulle liefhet. Hy, Jesus, die Messias, die Here, die Koning. Maar dan, liewe luisteraar, is daar altyd, en so is dit duidelik ook weer hier in Matteus 9, dat is altyd een vijand. Maar wie is dit? Die Romeine? Ja, dit is die Romeine. Hulle wat nasies verdruk, en die Jode verdruk. Maar wie sit achter die Romeine? Daar is nog die vijand, wat Paulus so duidelik tot praat in Efesiërs 6 vers 10. Praat hy van ons stryd. Is nie teen vlees en bloed nie, maar teen die owerhede, die magte, die wêreldheersers, die bose geeste. Daar agter die organisasie of die systeem waaronder jy lei miskien, wat het moeilik maak vir jou. Achter hierdie een of daardie een, wat die lewe baie, baie moeilik maak, achter dit is die bose, die Satan, achter die wêreldheerskappy, die bose, wat daarop uit is om God se werk, sy koninkryk te stuit om te verhoed dat sondaars gered word. Ja, die bose wat alles inspan om Jesus in sy spore te stuit. Het Jesus selfs probeer vermoor as kind deur die owerhede. Het Jesus probeer verlei in die woestyn. Het Jesus deur ook die godsdienstige leiers dit baie moeilik vir hom probeer maak. en dit sou nog meer en meer en meer word, om Jesus te stuit in wat hy gekom het om te doen. Die vijand wil Godse verlossing van Israel verhoed, die verlossing wat dwars deur die Oud Testament verkondig is, gebring is deur profete. Die vijand, maar wie is die vijand? Ja, die Romeine, Satan self aan die einde van die dag. Die mense om Jesus besef nie hoe die bose die mens verlei deur jou eie begeertes en jou vrese nie. Soos met die fariseers, hierdie man wat hierdie wonderwerke doen, moet gestuit word. Want hulle, die fariseers, die skrifkenners, die godsdienstige leiers, hulle is die bewakers van Israel. Hulle wil die mag en die erkenning hê van die mense. En nou hier het hulle een kans, sien hulle, om hom verdag te maak. En dan wanneer hy die demone uitdryf, dan sê hulle, hy doen dit deur die aanvoerder van die demone, Satan. Is dit nie iets wat jy ook ken nie? Dat iemand onwaarhede versprei, sodat die goeie nie sal seevier nie, sodat die waarheid nie sal uitkom nie. Ek dink jy het ergens in jou lewe ervaar ons dit. Ek het dit in my lewe ervaar. Mense is soms so oortuig van hulle siening. Dit wat hulle wil hê, of dit wat hulle vrees, om dit te kry, of te weerhou van, om selfwaarde te kry. Ja, dit gebeur met ons allemaal, met my ook, dat jy dit voel, maar, en dan besef jy maar, nee, dit gaan eintlik omdat ek iets wil hê. Dit is so makkelijk, om die bose daar buiten in ons nie raak te sien nie, en dan iemand anders verdag te maak. En in die proces word dit wat reg en goed is, die geregtigheid van Christus, die volledige regte lewe, word dit beskadig. Dit kan nie regtig beskadig word nie, want dit is sy lewe wat hy vir ons gegee het. Maar ons is sy kinders, ons is sy beeld, ons is die een wat die blye boodskap uitdra. En wanneer dit verdag word, dan word dit baie moeiliker om dit uit te dra. Maar wat doen Jesus? Hy wat verdag gemaak word deur hulle. Hy gaan aan om die koninkryk te verkondig en in al die dorpe elke siekte en kwaal te genees, sê vers 35 vir ons, Matteus 9 vers 35. Hy gaan aan met sy koninkryk werk. Hy red, hy het gekom om te genees. Word jy deur dit wat mense sê, en verdagmakerij, word jy daardeur gestop, omdat jy dink, maar dan is ek nie goed genoeg nie? Of gaan jy ook aan, om in liefde en in nederigheid, maar oortuigheid en krag, sy koninkryk, te lewe en uit te dra, die nuwe lewe wat jy van Jesus deur die geloof ontvang het. Miskien, lieve luisteraar, ervaar jy nou struikelblokke in jou lewe, deur die siekte, selfs die dood, of dit wat ander van jou sê, of hoe moeilik dit vir jou gemaak word in die situasie waarin jy is, dat het Jesus nie gestuit nie. Hy het geweet waarin hy op pad is. Hy is op pad na die kruis. om sy lewe te gee vir juis hierdie mense wat hy lief het. En hy sê vir jou en my, volg my. Volg my, sê Jesus. Kan ons hom nie volg nie? Hy, wat sy lewe vir ons gegee het, wat aan ons 'n nuwe lewe en 'n nuwe toekoms gegee het, sal iets jou stuit om waarlik die koninkryk te bring, om dit te lewe? Kom ons geniet so 'n bietjie musiek, luister daarna, en dan kom ons weer saam in hierdie program. Bly ingeskakel. Daar kom terug by die program Krag van die Woord, om ook saam met my, Marie Skalik, om werklik te oordink wat die Here vir ons sê. Hier in Matteus 9, wanneer Jesus al hierdie wonderwerke doen en demone uitdryf, kom maak die fariseers om verdag. En sê, hy doen dit. Hy dryf demone uit, ja. Maar hy doen dit deur die owerste van die demone. Satan self. Maar dan sê Matteus, al maak hulle vir hom verdag, hy noem het amper so terloops, maar op alle plekke baie duideliker. En Jesus sal hulle baie duideliker ook in Matteus 12 antwoord. Maar hier sê Matteus eenvoudig, Jesus gaan aan om in al die dorpe die koninkryk te verkondig en mense gezond te maak en demone uit te drijf. Hy doen dit. Want net in die volgende hoofstuk wat ons binnenkort gaan oordink en lees, Matteus 10, gaan hy sy disippels uitstuur om dieselfde te doen wat hy doen. En nou wys hy eintlik ook vir hulle wat eintlik hulle te wagte is, verdagmakerij, vyandskap, dit alles kom op die pad, wanneer jy die koninkryk uitlewe en die koninkryk verkondig. Hier aan die einde van hoofstuk 9, dan is dit wat Jesus so diep in hom lê, in God van die begin af, van sy skepping af, so diep in God sy hart lê, en so duidelik maak die Bybel vir ons die Here sy hart oop, dan hier van Jesus die Here. Hy kry die skare innig jammer, omdat hulle verward en verstrooid is. Skape sonder 'n herder. Sy jammerte en sy hartseer en sy liefde is so diep, wanneer hy hierdie verwarring sien onder die mense. Verward vanweë die bose, wat deur mense werk, sodat hulle die waarheid en die goeie nuus nie kan hoor, maar het eerder verwarring bring. En dit is so met die evangelie. Die evangelie kom nie in mag en geweld nie, maar het kom in die woord van die Here. Dit kom deur sy gees wat in ons woon, sy kinders. En toch, hoe baie keer is ons verward, hoe baie keer is Christene verward. Wat sê die Here hiervan, wat sê die Here daarvan? En dan kom daar so groot verwarring, dat hulle nie eers meer die liefde van die Here vir hulle, en wie hulle is in hom, kan sien nie. So diep is baie keer ons ou denke. Hoe ons dan dinge moet gebeur. En wanneer die Here so jou anders kom, dan hoor ons hom nie en sien ons hom nie. En dit is miskien een van die redes waarom mense so graag wil hê, hulle wil sterk leier hê wat beheer neem en duidelik rigting gee. Toch God het so. By al die volke, al die kulture, mense wil iemand hê wat die stang vastbyt en sê, kom en ons doen dit. Een aardse koning, wat Israel al hê van ouds af. Ja, hulle wou hê dat Moses eerder daar in die woestijn, tussen hulle en God moet staan. Ons sien vandag ook dat mense wil een sterk leier hê. Internationale leier. Wat sê, dit doen ons en ons doen het so en ego gedrewe doen ons dit. En gebruik al die mag. Party doen het meer op 'n subtiele manier. Ander gee nie eens om nie. Want die mense wil het hê. Maar liewe luisteraar, dis nie hoe Jesus lei nie. Ja, hy sê wel, volg my. Maar hy doen het nie met 'n ystere hand nie. Soos 'n boelie nie. Hy vernietig nie op die pad nie. Matteus skryf dit hier, hy het 'n liefde en 'n jammerte in hom, maar omgee. Hy maak heel. En hy sal uiteindelik sterf aan die kruis. Nie die legioene engele wat tot sy beskikking is, en dit 'n derde wat geval het met Satan. Maar die res, legioene, engele, wat hy kon roep, om alles uit te wis. Ja, God kon altyd, daar het die skepping en die mens, die bose ingelaatheid, in die lewe, in die harte, en daarmee die skepping vernietig het, so ver hulle gegaan het, kon God lank al het gesê, het is klaar, alles vernietig het. Maar dit is nie God werk nie, dit is met geduld en liefde, gaan hy aan, totdat hy self aan die kruis kom sterwe. As mens, so dat hy sy koninkryk vestig vir altyd. Ja, jy kan misverstaan word, wanneer jy nie die pad van beheer en geweld neem nie. Jy kan verdag gemaak word, want sy koninkryk is die koninkryk vir armes van gees, vir hongeres en dorstiges, hulle wat heel gemaak wil word. Sy koninkryk is waar jy jou vyande kan lief hê. Sy koninkryk is waar jy nie vir geld nie, oog vir 'n oog en 'n tand vir 'n tand. Sy koninkryk is die wat hy sy lewe voorgegee het, sy geregtigheid, so dat hulle 'n heel hart kan hê, suiwer. Is jy een van hulle? En as jy nie is nie, hoor jy hom? Hoe hy met deernis vir jou sê, draai na my, vra na my, ek het my lewe vir jou gegee, hier is dit, ontvang dit deur die geloof. En jy wat hom reeds ken, hoor hoe hy sê, die arbeiders is min, bid, dat daar meer arbeiders sal kom. Hy is hier. Jy is deel van hom. Wie sal hy stuur? Dit laat my dink aan toe die Here Jesaja geroep het. Jesaja 6. As die Here, wie sal ek stuur? Dan eers sê Jesaja, maar ek is onrein, Here. Dan wys die Here dat hy hom genees, dat hy hom skoon maak, volledig maak. Net soos Jesus ook vir jou sê, jy kan by my, uit my hand, die volledige lewe, my lewe kry, sodat dit jou identiteit is, jy kan uit my gees uit lewe. Dit is wie jy is. Ek stuur jou dan. Maar hy sal jou nie dwing nie. Hy sal nie met mag en geweld kom. Nee, hy roep jou. Sal ek jou stuur? Daar is so baie wat dit moet hoor. My evangelie, my liefde, my genade. Sal jy dit doen? Here, ons kom na u toe en ons hoor u woorde. Wanneer jy die skare jammer kry, daar is so min arbeiders. Here, wil u bring, soos as die wind daar buite hoor, wil u bring dat daar meer en meer kom. Wat besef ons hoef nie ver weg te kyk na ander nie, maar deur dit wat ons doen, en dit wat ons sê, dat ons u evangelie laat uitgaan, dat u woord gehoor word. Dankie Here. Stuur my. Want ek kom van u af, en ek ga na u toe. En jy wil baie meer saamneem. Ons vra dit in jy groot naam, met diep ontzag in ons harte. Want wie is daar soos jy? Jy is die Here. Amen. Dankie dat jy kon saam met my reflekteer en dink oor hierdie woorde van Matteus. Lees het gerus weer. En ervaar die seën van die Here in hierdie dag en elke dag. Tot ziens.
Hierdie inset was aan jou gebring met die komplimente van Radio Kaapse Kansel 729 AM. Besoek ons gerus by www.capepulpit.co.za.